Honorable the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of the United States are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Barrett has the opinions of the court in two cases this morning.
This case is FDA versus RJR Reynolds Vapor Company. The Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, which I'll call the TCA for short, makes it illegal for companies to make or sell any new tobacco product unless the FDA first decides that the product is appropriate for the protection of the public health. When e-cigarettes first became popular in America, the FDA did not treat them as new tobacco products, so they were bought and sold without prior FDA approval. But in 2016, the FDA changed course. Starting then, e-cigarette manufacturers had to show that their products were appropriate for the protection of the public health, or else the products would go off the market. RJ Reynolds Vapor Company, I'm going to call it RJR Vapor for short, sold multiple Vuse Alto branded e-cigarette products, and it applied to the FDA for permission to keep selling them. The FDA denied those applications. And if that denial order was upheld, it would take one of the most popular e-cigarette brands off the market. RJR Vapor sued, arguing that the FDA was required to approve its applications. But the case before us today isn't about the substance of the FDA's denial order. It's instead about where the lawsuit about that denial order will happen. And as it turns out, where this lawsuit proceeds depends on who is allowed to challenge the order. The TCA allows any person adversely affected by one of the FDA's denial orders to challenge that order in either the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit or the U.S. Court of Appeals where the challenger resides. This phrase, adversely affected, is the key phrase in the statute, so every time I say it, imagine there are quotation marks around it. There is no question that RJR Vapor was adversely affected by the denial order. After all, it made e-cigarettes and could no longer sell them. RJR Vapor is a North Carolina company, and North Carolina is located in the Fourth Circuit. So if RJR Vapor proceeded alone, it could challenge the FDA in the D.C. Circuit or the Fourth Circuit. But RJR Vapor decided to team up with retailers who sold its products in Texas and Mississippi, states that are both located in the Fifth Circuit. Acting jointly, RJR Vapor and the retailers filed there. The FDA cried foul. It asked the Fifth Circuit to either dismiss the challenge or send it to the D.C. Circuit or the Fourth Circuit. According to the FDA, the retailers were not adversely affected by a denial order and thus could not seek review of it. If the FDA was right about that, then RJR Vapor would need to bring its suit alone. And if RJR Vapor was alone, it couldn't stay in the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit disagreed with the FDA and kept the case. It held that the retailers were adversely affected by the FDA's refusal to authorize the sale of products that they wish to sell. We agree with the Fifth Circuit. Terms like adversely affected and aggrieved are familiar ones. Congress often uses variations of this phrase to describe who can bring a lawsuit. Most famously, this language is used in the Administrative Procedure Act's cause of action. And in that context, we have interpreted the phrase broadly as allowing any person to sue who is even arguably within the zone of interest that a statute intends to protect. The FDA argues that the APA is special and that here we should give adversely affected a narrower meaning. But our cases do not support this APA is special approach. On the contrary, we have interpreted several statutes that use variations of the phrase adversely affected, and we have held that the phrase reaches anyone who even arguably falls within the statute's zone of interest. We see no reason to give the phrase a different meaning here. So anyone who is even arguably within the interests that the TCA seeks to protect may challenge the FDA's denial order. The retailers fit the bill. They want to sell Vuse-Alto branded products, and the FDA's denial order is the difference between their having a lucrative business and facing the threat of criminal penalties for selling illegal, unauthorized tobacco products. That direct impact is more than enough to show that the retailers are adversely affected by the FDA's denial order. The FDA pushes back, claiming that Congress intended for only the manufacturer applicant, here that would be RJR Vapor, to be able to challenge a denial order. But the FDA's speculations about congressional purpose cannot be squared with the text that Congress actually enacted. The word any suggests that Congress wanted this cause of action to extend to multiple persons, not just one. And the phrase person adversely affected, instead of, say, party or applicant, suggests that Congress wanted to look beyond the people directly involved in the FDA proceeding. Indeed, Congress used the phrase holder of the application in a different provision of the TCA, allowing only holders of applications to challenge any order from the FDA that withdraws a prior approval given. And that meaningful variation shows that Congress had something else in mind when it said that any person adversely affected could file a challenge. For the first time before this court, the FDA asks us to hold that even if the retailers could sue by themselves, RJR Vapor couldn't team up with them in the same lawsuit. No court has ever analyzed that question, and it would be imprudent for us to be the first. We thus affirm the Fifth Circuit's order denying the FDA's motion to transfer venue. Justice Jackson has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Sotomayor joins. I also have the opinion of the court in Asteris versus United States. When sentencing a criminal defendant, a federal district court may impose a term of imprisonment, a term of probation, or a fine. When it does so, it must apply 10 factors set forth in 18 U.S.C. 3553, which I will call the sentencing factors. If the court imposes a term of imprisonment, it may, and sometimes it must, also impose a term of supervised release. A term of supervised release begins once the defendant is released from prison. And as the name suggests, the defendant is supervised during this period, and he is also subject to conditions on his behavior. If the defendant violates these conditions, say by committing another crime or failing to submit to drug testing, the court may revoke his supervised release and require that the defendant spend additional time in prison. Back to the sentencing factors I mentioned a moment ago. When a court decides whether to impose a term of supervised release, the statute says that the court shall consider 8 of the 10 traditional sentencing factors. And if the court later revokes supervised release, the statute says that the court shall consider the same abbreviated set of factors. One of the two factors that Congress left out is 3553A2A. To appreciate the significance of this provision, some background may be helpful. There are 4 traditional purposes of criminal punishment. First, rehabilitation serves to teach the defendant to become a law-abiding person. Second, deterrence serves to discourage the defendant and others from committing crimes. Third, incapacitation serves to protect the public by preventing the defendant from committing further crimes. And fourth, retribution serves to ensure that the defendant receives just deserts for the harm he has caused. This last purpose, retribution, might be what you typically think of when you think of criminal punishment. Section 3553A2A speaks to this purpose, retribution. And in the context of a revocation proceeding, it speaks to retribution vis-a-vis the defendant's original criminal offense, not the conduct that triggered the revocation of his supervised release. For simplicity, I'll refer to 3553A2A as the retribution factor. The question in this case is what to make of the fact that Congress left the retribution factor off the list of sentencing factors that the court must consider when considering whether to revoke supervised release. The petitioners here are three criminal defendants who, for various reasons, had their terms of supervised release revoked. They argue that Congress omitted the retribution factor from the list to preclude district courts from considering it. In other words, they say, when deciding whether to revoke supervised release, a district court cannot aim to punish the defendant for his underlying criminal offense. That's already been done by the original sentence. The government, by contrast, says that district courts may choose to consider retribution with respect to the original offense, but they aren't required to do so. We agree with the petitioners. When Congress includes some items from a list but omits others, we usually conclude that the omitted items are excluded. So here, by including most of the sentencing factors while omitting the retribution factor, Congress indicated that district courts should not consider that factor in revocation proceedings and thus should not aim to use that revocation proceeding to punish the defendant for his underlying offense. In reaching this conclusion, we have statutory text, precedent, and common sense on our side. As for statutory text, many other provisions in the criminal sentencing statute require district courts to consider all the sentencing factors, which renders Congress's omission of the retribution factor in this context particularly meaningful. As for precedent, we have already said exactly what we say today. In fact, we've done so twice. Finally, common sense. As I mentioned earlier, supervised release is not punishment. It is designed to rehabilitate criminal defendants. So when a defendant violates the conditions of his supervised release, district courts may sensibly consider the forward-looking ends of sentencing, such as deterrence, incapacitation, or rehabilitation, but not the backward-looking purpose of retribution for the crime originally committed. In short, we hold today that district courts may not consider the retribution factor when revoking a defendant's term of supervised release. Because the Sixth Circuit concluded otherwise, we vacate its judgments and remand for further proceedings. Justice Sotomayor has filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment, in which Justice Jackson joins. Justice Jackson has filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment. Justice Alito has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Gorsuch joins.
Justice Kavanaugh has the opinion of the court this morning in two cases.
The first opinion I have to announce is number 23-1226, McLaughlin versus McKesson. This case involves the Telephone Consumer Protection Act of 1991, or TCPA. The TCPA protects businesses and consumers from intrusive telemarketing communications. Among other restrictions, the TCPA prohibits a business from sending an unsolicited advertisement by fax, absent an opt-out notice informing recipients that they can choose not to receive future faxes. McKesson Corporation is a healthcare company. In 2009 and 2010, in an effort to promote McKesson's products, McKesson sent unsolicited fax advertisements to various medical practices. McLaughlin Chiropractic Associates received some of those faxes. McLaughlin later sued McKesson. McLaughlin alleged that McKesson violated the TCPA by faxing unsolicited advertisements without the opt-out notice that the statute requires. The TCPA sets damages at $500 for each unsolicited fax sent without an opt-out notice. McLaughlin requested damages, and it also sought to represent a class of other recipients of McKesson's faxes and make this a class action lawsuit. That class action point is important because class actions alleging TCPA violations can turn out to involve millions of dollars in claim damages, given the $500 per fax and statutory damages, and given the number of unsolicited faxes that businesses sometimes would send to different potential customers without opt-out notices. Here, some recipients of the faxes, including McLaughlin, had received faxes on a traditional fax machine, the standalone device dedicated to receiving and printing faxes. But others had received the faxes through online fax services, either by email or through an online portal. The district court certified a class of fax recipients, drawing no distinction between faxes received on traditional fax machines and faxes received through online fax services. As McLaughlin's lawsuit progressed, another company with no connection to the litigation petitioned the Federal Communications Commission for a declaratory ruling about whether the TCPA actually applies to faxes received through online fax services as distinct from those received through standalone fax machines. Months after the district court certified the class in McLaughlin's suit, the FCC issued an order, known as the AmeriFactors Order, ruling that the TCPA does not prohibit those faxes sent through online fax services. As the parties here recognized, if the FCC's AmeriFactors order were binding on the district court in this litigation, it would undermine McLaughlin's class action lawsuit because McLaughlin defined the class to include plaintiffs who received unsolicited faxes through online fax services. After receiving briefing on the issue, the district court deemed the FCC's AmeriFactors order a final binding order that dictated the court's interpretation of the TCPA. On appeal, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit agreed that the district court was bound by the FCC's AmeriFactors order. This court granted review to decide whether the district court was required to follow the FCC's legal interpretation of the TCPA. As explained at some length in the court's opinion today, we conclude that the answer is no, and we therefore disagree with the Court of Appeals and the district court. District courts in enforcement proceedings like this are not bound by an agency's interpretation of the relevant statute. Here, therefore, the district court should interpret the TCPA as courts traditionally do under ordinary principles of statutory interpretation, affording appropriate respect to the FCC's interpretation, but without being bound by the FCC's interpretation. In sum, we reverse the judgment of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Justice Kagan has filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson have joined. The second case I have to announce is number 24-7, Diamond Alternative Energy versus Environmental Protection Agency. Several years ago, under a provision of the Clean Air Act, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, approved California regulations requiring automakers to alter their fleets of new vehicles. Under those California regulations, automakers must manufacture more electric vehicles and fewer gasoline-powered vehicles. The goal is to decrease greenhouse gas and other emissions from the use of gasoline and other liquid fuels in cars. Producers of gasoline and other liquid fuels sued EPA, arguing that EPA's approval of the California regulations violated the Clean Air Act. The sole issue before this court is a preliminary one, whether the fuel producers have standing to maintain their suit in court. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit held that the fuel producers lack standing to sue. We disagree. The fuel producers have standing, and we therefore reverse the judgment of the D.C. Circuit. Article 3 of the Constitution confines the jurisdiction of federal courts to cases and controversies. For a lawsuit to constitute a case within the meaning of Article 3, the plaintiffs must have standing to sue. To demonstrate standing, plaintiffs must answer a basic question: what's it to you? In other words, plaintiffs must show that they possess a personal stake in the dispute and are not mere bystanders. This court's cases have established that standing contains three elements: injury in fact, causation, and redressability. Here, as for injury in fact, the fuel producers make money by selling fuel. Therefore, a decrease in purchases of gasoline and other liquid fuels resulting from the California regulation hurts their bottom line. Those monetary costs are, of course, an injury in fact. As to causation and redressability, common sense economic principles demonstrate that the fuel producers have satisfied those standing requirements as well. The California regulations force automakers to manufacture more electric vehicles and fewer gasoline-powered vehicles. That, in turn, means fewer consumer purchases of gasoline and other liquid fuels, which, of course, causes monetary harm to the fuel producers. And invalidating the regulations would redress the fuel producers' monetary injuries because more gasoline-powered cars would be manufactured and sold, meaning that more gasoline and other liquid fuel would be purchased. All of that is fairly commonsensical. Still, EPA and California push back on that reasoning, asserting that this case is unusual. They primarily suggest that the new vehicle market has developed in a way that even if the California regulations are invalidated, automakers would not likely manufacture or sell more gasoline-powered cars than they do now. So they argue that the fuel producers have not established redressability. They say that the fuel producers' injuries would not be redressed even if the California regulations were invalidated. To begin with, that is an odd argument for EPA and California to advance to try to defeat standing. After all, if invalidating the regulations would change nothing in the market, why are EPA and California enforcing and defending the regulations? The whole point of the regulations is to increase the number of electric vehicles in the new automobile market beyond what consumers would otherwise demand and what automakers would otherwise manufacture and sell. And EPA and California have been tenaciously defending the regulations for several years, presumably because they think the regulations still make a difference in the market. In any event, the evidence in the record in this case confirms what common sense tells us. Invalidating the regulations likely would make a difference for the fuel producers because automakers would likely manufacture more vehicles that run on gasoline and other liquid fuels. So there would be an increase in purchases of gasoline and other liquid fuels from the fuel producers. Consider just a few examples of record evidence. When originally seeking EPA's approval for the regulations, California itself estimated that its standards would produce substantial reductions in demand for gasoline, exceeding $1 billion beginning in 2020 and increasing to over $10 billion in 2030. Around that time, EPA likewise acknowledged that the California regulations would reduce consumption of fuel and credited California's estimates that the regulations would continue reducing greenhouse gas emissions in California through at least 2037. Moreover, five automakers predicted that absent California's regulations, other automakers would seek a competitive advantage over them by selling fewer electric vehicles and more gasoline-powered vehicles. In short, EPA's and California's own actions, their statements, their enforcement decisions, and their litigation positions, as well as other evidence in the record, undermines the central premise of their redressability argument. When, as here, a government seeks to justify its regulatory actions by, on the one hand, touting the consequences for fuel usage and emissions, while on the other maintaining that those same regulations are unreviewable in court because there are no consequences, courts can appropriately be skeptical. In the words of one of this court's prior cases, judges are not required to exhibit a naivete from which ordinary citizens are free. In sum, as this court has said before, courts should not make standing law more complicated than it needs to be. The government generally may not target a business or industry through stringent and allegedly unlawful regulation and then evade the resulting lawsuits by claiming that the targets of its regulation should be locked out of court as unaffected bystanders. In light of this court's precedents and the evidence before the Court of Appeals, the fuel producers here established Article III standing to challenge EPA's approval of the California regulations. To be clear, this case concerns only standing, not the merits. EPA and California may or may not prevail against the fuel producers on the merits in defending EPA's approval of the California regulations. But the fuel producers clearly have standing to sue and have the merits of their legal arguments decided by the federal courts. For those reasons, we reverse the judgment of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Justice Sotomayor and Justice Jackson have each filed dissenting opinions.
Justice Gorsuch has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23997, Stanley versus City of Sanford.
The Americans with Disabilities Act bars employers from discriminating against qualified individuals on the basis of disability. The statute defines a qualified individual as someone who, with or without reasonable accommodation, can perform the essential functions of the employment position that she holds or desires. This case asks us to decide whether that definition extends to retirees, like petitioner Karen Stanley, who neither hold nor desire a job when they experience an alleged act of discrimination. To answer that question, we turn as we must to the instructions Congress has given us. When the ADA defines the term qualified individual, it uses present tense verbs. The statute makes it unlawful to discriminate against someone who can perform the essential functions of the job she holds or desires. Those verbs indicate that the statute protects individuals who, with or without reasonable accommodation, are able to do the job they hold or seek when they suffer discrimination. By the same token, those verbs suggest the statute does not reach retirees who neither hold nor desire a job when an act of discrimination occurs. Other parts of the statutes reinforce our assessment. So, for example, recall that the ADA prohibits discrimination against an individual who can perform essential job functions with or without a reasonable accommodation. And a reasonable accommodation, the statute says, refers to things like altering training materials. Accommodations that make perfect sense for current or prospective employees, but not retired ones. Even beyond that, a number of other statutory clues discussed in our opinion, and I will not bore you with, also indicate that to prevail in a suit for employment discrimination under the ADA, a plaintiff must plead and prove that she either held or desired a job and could perform its functions with or without a reasonable accommodation at the time of the employer's alleged act of discrimination. Now, saying that much is enough to answer the question we took this case to resolve and the circuit split that led to it. But for the first time in her merits briefing, Ms. Stanley asked us to address still another question. Although her petition for certiorari focused on discrimination against retirees, she now tells us that she also suffered discrimination while she was employed. So even if the ADA protects only those who hold or seek a job when they suffer discrimination, she says, we should decide whether her case satisfies that standard. Ordinarily, this court rejects efforts like that to inject new questions into a case after we have granted review. But a plurality of the court finds it profitable to make an exception here to outline three separate theories retirees like Ms. Stanley can still pursue consistent with the ADA's terms. Those theories, we conclude, cannot help Ms. Stanley herself because of case-specific considerations, including deficiencies in her complaint and her failure to pursue the theories below. But as we explain, future plaintiffs might avoid those missteps, and even Ms. Stanley herself might try to cure them in future proceedings. For these reasons and others detailed in our opinion, the judgment of the 11th Circuit is affirmed. Justice Thomas has filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment, which Justice Barrett has joined. Justice Sotomayor has filed an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part. Justice Jackson has filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Sotomayor has joined in part.
I have the opinion of the court in case 2420, Fold versus Palestine Liberation Organization and the consolidated case. Before us are two lawsuits against the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, and the Palestinian Authority, the PA, entities responsible for carrying out governmental functions in parts of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. While other countries recognize the PLO and the PA as sovereign, the United States does not. In fact, the United States has for decades restricted their activities on U.S. soil, in part out of concerns over their support for acts of overseas terrorism. As part of the federal government's wider legal response to international terrorism, Congress enacted the Anti-Terrorism Act of 1990, the ATA, which creates a civil damages remedy, including for aiding and abetting liability, in federal court for any U.S. national killed or injured by an act of overseas terrorism. In the cases before us, plaintiffs injured or killed by such acts brought ATA suits in federal district court in New York against the PLO and the PA. Both sets of plaintiffs asserted that the district courts had personal jurisdiction over those entities. Personal jurisdiction is a term of art. It refers to a court's power to hear a case with regard to a particular individual or entity. As the basis for personal jurisdiction, the plaintiffs cited the Promoting Security and Justice for Victims of Terrorism Act, what I'll call the Promoting Security and Justice Act for short. That act refers to the PLO and the PA by name and states that they, quote, shall be deemed to have consented to personal jurisdiction, end quote, in ATA cases in two enumerated circumstances. The first is when the PLO and the PA make payments to people imprisoned for committing an act of terrorism that injured or killed an American. The second is when those two entities undertake certain specified activities on U.S. soil. The trial courts found that the evidence showed that the PLO and the PA had engaged in conduct sufficient to satisfy at least the first prong. But both courts went on to hold that the assertion of personal jurisdiction under the Promoting Security and Justice Act was unconstitutional. The Court of Appeals agreed, and we granted review at the behest of the plaintiffs and the United States, which had intervened to defend the law's constitutionality. The requirement that a court have personal jurisdiction over a defendant, we have said, flows from the Due Process Clause. Our modern personal jurisdiction cases have considered only the limitations imposed by the 14th Amendment on the authority of state courts. Those standards derive from a 1945 case known as International Shoe versus Washington and have been reviewed in many subsequent cases over the decades. As every first-year law student learns, in order for a state court to exercise personal jurisdiction over a defendant, consistent with the 14th Amendment, the defendant must have minimum contacts with the forum state. That means he must have taken some act to purposefully avail himself of the privilege of conducting activities in that state. That ensures that maintaining suit is reasonable, and it does not offend traditional notions of fair play and substantial justice to hail him into the courts of that particular state. We have repeatedly emphasized that these standards are driven by two related but distinguishable principles, treating defendants fairly and protecting interstate federalism. In the 14th Amendment context, the later concern, interstate federalism, recognizes that the 14th Amendment's limits on personal jurisdiction are important to the orderly administration of laws in our federal system of government. In that system, the sovereign authority of each state is bounded by that state's borders, and the limitations on personal jurisdiction imposed by the 14th Amendment help ensure that the states do not, through their courts, exercise authority beyond those territorial limitations. The PLO and the PA urge us to apply this familiar 14th Amendment framework here. We decline to do so. The language of the 5th and 14th Amendments is almost identical, but the 5th Amendment applies to the federal government and the 14th to the states. That distinction makes a difference. The federal government, unlike the states, has exclusive and unique powers in the international sphere. While the authority of each state is bounded by its geographical borders, there is no equivalent imaginary border around the exterior of the United States. Given the distinct territorial reach of the federal government's sovereign power, we hold that the limitations imposed by the 14th Amendment on the authority of state courts are not applicable to the federal government. Rather, the 5th Amendment permits a more flexible jurisdictional inquiry commensurate with the federal government's broader sovereign authority. Now, we do not, however, determine definitively in these cases the outer bounds of the federal government's power to hail foreign defendants into U.S. courts. The private petitioners argue that the 5th Amendment imposes no territorial limits on personal jurisdiction. The United States asks us not to embrace, at least for now, this maximalist theory. Because the Promoting Security and Justice Act ties federal jurisdiction to conduct closely related to the United States that implicates important and ongoing foreign policy concerns, we agree with the government that we may leave this broader theory for another day. Whatever the outer limits of the 5th Amendment on the territorial jurisdiction of federal courts may be, this statute does not transgress them. Rather, this act represents a considered judgment on a sensitive matter of foreign policy combating international terrorism that is within the prerogative of the political branches. The act is also appropriately limited in scope to that end, as it only triggers jurisdiction if the PLO or the PA engage in certain enumerated conduct and only for ATA suits. In that sense, the statute puts the PLO and the PA on full, unambiguous notice that they could be subject to personal jurisdiction in suits like the ones before us. In addition, even if the 5th Amendment, like the 14th Amendment, requires an evaluation of whether the assertion of jurisdiction is reasonable in this particular case, the Promoting Security and Justice Act easily passes muster under the factors we have looked to in evaluating fairness to the defendant under the 14th Amendment. Indeed, the PLO and the PA do not complain that litigating these cases in the United States would be an unfair burden. Accordingly, we hold that the Promoting Security and Justice Act's provision for personal jurisdiction comports with the Due Process Clause of the 5th Amendment. The judgments of the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit are reversed, and the cases are remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Justice Thomas has filed an opinion concurring in the judgment in which Justice Gorsuch joined as to Part 2.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Thursday, the 26th of June at 10 o'clock.